Okay, good morning, class. You should probably turn the volume down just a little bit. Okay, this is about 2:41. And what is the date today? Let's see, looks like the 27th right here. Good, 27th. I left my watch at home. And so on Tuesday, you did take your first exam. That's done, and grades are in Blackboard. Definitely stop by during office hours, take a look at the test and the answer key, because you learn a lot on how to take the next test. And my goodness, when is the next test? March 25th. That's going to be exam number 2, and it's going to cover 3 chapters, 4, 5, and 7. 7 is a real important chapter. That's nervous system. All right, so if you ran out of time studying, maybe what I would recommend is to print out all the exam study guides right now. Maybe don't work on all of them, but at least see what the scope of the class is so that you can pace yourself through those study guides. All right, just see what the whole job will entail and then try to fit that in by the next test. All right, any questions on the schedule? Any questions on the test? Oh, I do have a comment about the test. Their question 100, you might get one more point for that, depending on how you answered it. I penciled in the wrong answer on the answer key. So that's just a possibility. You might have actually one more. It had to do with ubiquitin and chaperone molecules and things like that. Okay. All right, so any questions on schedule or the test or anything like that? All right, so that'd be really nice if you were to stop by, and then I would actually meet some of you, because I don't even know a lot of you because I don't have you for lab. All right, so what we're going to do today then is Chapter 4. Chapter 4 is a highly conceptual chapter, and we're going to be doing a little bit of physics, actually, in this particular chapter. So let's get it booted up and going. Where is the little button? Nice. And then I want to do this. Okay, so that y'all can see. And maybe I'll turn the light down just a little bit. Ah, nice. Okay, Chapter 4, Enzymes and Energy. Not sure that everybody in here knows what an enzyme is. Probably you've heard of them. But we need to know exactly what they're doing in our body, what are some of the wonderful things they do in our body. And I want these markers right here. Here's the sign-in sheet for today. Okay, so we're going to look at enzymes, enzyme control metabolic pathways. We don't talk a whole lot about a specific kind of metabolic pathway in this chapter, but when we get into respiratory chapter, respiration, we'll learn a lot about metabolic pathways. And then bioenergetics. This is the energy needed to run these metabolic pathways and to run our bodies. All right, so let's first consider enzymes. All right, enzymes are biological catalysts. Well, what the heck does that mean? Let's start. You know what biology stands for, right? The biology has to do with maybe organic molecules like proteins or sugar molecules. But what the heck is a catalyst? A catalyst is something. It doesn't have to be an enzyme, but it has to be something that speeds up the rate of a reaction. Okay? It can't change whether that reaction will want to happen or not want to happen, but it will just speed up the rate of it. Like, for instance, if we have a piece of wood and we want to turn it into carbon dioxide and water, how would we usually do that if we have a piece of wood and maybe a fireplace? We would have to, like, stick this wood in our fireplace and then with a match heat that wood up to a really high temperature. We'd have to put in a lot of energy before, all right, that piece of wood would catch on fire. But there's a way, all right, to burn wood without that high temperature, and that is by putting some zinc on it. And zinc then will catalyze that reaction of wood, which is cellulose, turning it into carbon dioxide and water rather rapidly. It won't burn it up like in a fireplace, but if we have a piece of wood on the table over here, just leave it alone. In 1,000 years when we come back, it still might be there. But if we put some zinc on it, it will basically get all used up, turned into carbon dioxide and water, and in a relatively short period of time, not 1,000 years, but probably in less than a year, within a matter of weeks. So a catalyst is something that speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. And another concept with a catalyst is that it does not get used up when it catalyzes a reaction. So when we say a reaction, what do we think of as a reaction? Well, we have a couple chemicals here. A plus B going over to C plus D. So these are the reactants, reactant molecules, and then these are the product molecules. All right, so an enzyme will just speed that reaction up. That's its whole job. And if the reaction can't go in that direction, an enzyme just won't allow it to happen. It will just speed up the rate of a reaction that will happen anyway. All right, in our body, most of these biological catalysts are proteins, which means, their building blocks are amino acids. There are a few that are RNA molecules, but by far the most are proteins. And there was one concept when we looked at proteins, and that is, what gives a protein a particular function? Their shape or their structure, right? All right, so these catalysts have to have a certain kind of structure before they can catalyze a reaction. All right, and so how do they speed up the rate of a reaction? By lowering the activation energy required for that reaction to proceed. Well, I need to give you a couple of graphs to see what we're talking about. But after you see it on a graph, go back and look at that that little word slide. All right, so here we have some graphs. And the top graph we have is just the number of reactant molecules, right? Just the number of A's or the number of B's in a particular location. And that's plotted out versus the energy of these reactants. And how is one way that you can think of energy? You could think of it in terms of heat or temperature, right? And if you increase the temperature of these molecules, A or B, what's going to happen to them? They're going to move around faster, right? They're going to jiggle around faster, and that's, you saw that when it came to understanding why temperature increases the rate of diffusion. All right, and not every A molecule has exactly the same energy. Right? There's going to be a distribution of energy of these reactants, and it kind of looks like a bell. We're going to just call this a bell-shaped curve. There are very, very few. Right here's number of reactants. There are very, very few with extremely low energy. There's very, very few with high energy because energy is increasing as we go to the right on that horizontal axis. Right, and by far, most of them have some average amount of energy. Okay, well, without an enzyme, okay, the reaction will take place with molecules way out here that have high energy. And if we look at the area underneath the curve, this will tell us about all the molecules that we have. So if we look at this area right here underneath the curve, we can say that these molecules have sufficient energy to undergo the reaction. And what is this population compared to everything that actually kind of looks like blue to me? What are these over here? Green? Yeah? Green. Okay, so what does the area of green look like compared to blue? Is it bigger, smaller, the same? It's much smaller, right? So in this particular circumstance, there are very few molecules that have sufficient energy to undergo a reaction. Let's look at the graph right down underneath it. So here we're just going to draw a particular kind of reaction, and we're going to use that hill analogy once again. And energy is plotted on the vertical axis this time, and it increases as you go higher and higher up, right? And we're going to look at this for the non-catalyzed reaction without an enzyme. All right, so if we have a ball on top of the hill, will it want to roll down the hill? Yeah. Absolutely, right? That's not too hard to see. But in this particular case, look, I have a little wall right here or a fence, right? And if we push this ball up against this fence, will it run down the hill? No, it won't, okay? So in this particular case, the reaction, right, the reactants won't turn into products because of this wall that is there. That's an energy of activation. So if we wanted to get this reaction to proceed, we would have to kick this ball up over this wall. And once it got over the wall, what would happen to it? then it would roll downhill in terms of energy and form products, right? But you got to get over this wall, right? So what happens when you have an enzyme in solution, right? Then the activation energy decreases, okay? Because we can see we move the activation energy over here. And now what can you say about the number of molecules that have sufficient energy to jump over that wall? Has it increased, stay the same, or decreased? It has increased. Okay, so with an enzyme, you can have still this exact same distribution of energy, exact same distribution of reactants, but now you have many more of them that have the energy to undergo that reaction. So in terms of that lower diagram, what does that mean in terms of this wall? With an enzyme present, the height of this wall decreases. So it takes less energy for the reactants to jump over it before they can roll downhill. All right. And when we look at this, let's analyze this graph just a little bit more. Okay, what has higher energy, the reactants or the products in this reaction? Remember, here is a plot of energy versus reaction. So as you go higher up, this means what? More and more energy. So in this particular case, reactants have a lot more energy than the products do on this particular illustration. All right, so that's what this axis means. And, yeah. Yeah. Okay, this is just showing you activation energy, okay, but not really the energy of the reactants. The energy of the reactants from the first graph to the second one over here isn't changing. So we're keeping the reactants just the same. We're not heating them up. We're not doing anything to them. And if we don't do anything to the reactants, right, the shape of this curve is not going to change, and it's not going to shift to the right or to the left, right? The reactant molecules are going to be the same over here and over here, right? But what this little arrow with activation energy signifies is that there is a lower activation energy on the right-hand slide, which means that you just have a greater population now of reactant molecules that have sufficient energy to undergo the reaction, right? So if we look at energy of the reactants, this curve right here, what can you tell me about this curve compared to this one here? They're the same. So we're not doing anything to the reactants whatsoever. So we're not putting in heat, we're not lighting a match underneath them, exactly the same circumstance. The only thing that we've done is that we've lowered this barrier before those reactants can turn into products. Okay, well, let's take a look. All right, kind of looks like a blue arrow to me. Which blue arrow is bigger, the one on the left or the one on the right? The one on the left is bigger, and that's really the activation energy. The height of this barrier is the activation energy, and it is a taller little structure on the left compared to the right. Do you kind of see that now?
Yeah, I see one on
top. Okay, on the top over here?
Yeah.
Okay, this... If we look at reactant molecules and we plot them out versus energy, we get this nice bell-shaped curve, just like that. And the only thing we do between the left and the right one is that we put an enzyme in solution. We don't change the temperature. We don't stir it up. We don't do anything to those reactant molecules. So if we don't do anything to those reactant molecules, what is going to, then this curve just can't change because we're not changing anything about them. They're just staying exactly the same. Right. They have the same energy distribution, where there's very few that have high energy, very few that have high energy, very few that have low energy, very few that have low energy, and most of them are like right smack here in the middle. And the same case over here. Most of them are right here smack in the middle. And what this arrow signifies is that when we put an enzyme in, this activation energy shifts around on the curve. The reactants stay exactly the same. It's just the height of this barrier changes. It becomes smaller. And as a matter of fact, if you put certain kinds of enzymes in, it goes away altogether, and then what happens? Well, these reactants form products very, very quickly and completely. Okay. So this pointed arrow right here just represents this activation energy barrier, right? And we can see it's what? It's moving over to the left, which means lower and lower energy. And so that activation energy decreases. And if we look at the distribution, it just says that there are many more reactants that have sufficient energy to undergo the reaction, to jump over this barrier right there. Okay. So the reactants aren't changed. That's a pretty important concept. The reactants don't have to do anything to speed up the rate of the reaction. The enzyme will take care of that. All right. So the reactants are at the same energy level, right? On the bottom graph on the left and the right, exactly the same energy level. The products are exactly at the same energy level on these two graphs. And the only thing that's changing is the rate of this particular reaction. And that's not drawn on this curve at all, right? But what is drawn on this curve is the activation energy, right? Because this is a plot of energy. And you can see that it's bigger on the left compared to the right. But there's something else that's important, right? When this reaction proceeds, we say that we have to put in a lot of energy. But when the reaction happens, what happens to that energy that we put in? It comes back out. All right, so the energy that's released is cancels the amount of energy that we put in to get the reaction going, and then the reaction proceeds all the way to products. So this activation energy we put in, but we get it back. It exactly cancels out. And let's take a look at the right-hand slide. Here are the reactants. We put energy in, right? Allow the reaction to happen, and then what happens to that activation energy? We get it back out again, exactly the same amount that we put in. All right, so that activation energy cancels out with the energy that's released in this particular reaction. And here is the important point that I want to make. What about the energy released in the reaction? And that we would measure by looking at the energy of the reactants and the energy of the products. And here is the height of that arrow. All right, so this is the amount of energy released in the reaction with a high activation energy barrier. Let's compare that with the catalyzed reaction. Here are the reactants, right? And are the reactants at a different energy level compared to the non-catalyzed reaction? I want you to see that. It's at the exact same energy level, okay? And what about the products? Are they at a different energy level between the left and right-hand side slide? Here we have it here, and here we have it here. Exact same level. So the energy released by the reaction on the right and left side is what? Exactly equal. So the enzyme doesn't change the amount of energy that's released. It just speeds up the rate of the reaction by decreasing this activation energy barrier. That's energy you have to put in, but during the reaction, okay, you get it back out. It just speeds up the rate of conversion of reactants to products. And the other thing that you'll have to be familiar with is that that enzyme doesn't get used up. What gets used up with this reaction? Okay, so here we have high energy in the reactants, low energy in products. So the products have less energy, so that means that energy is released. Yeah, energy is being released because you have more over here. If the reactants have more energy than the products, then energy is released to something. We call that an exergonic reaction. Okay. All right, so the reactants at the same energy level, the products are at the same energy level. The only thing that changes is the activation energy for a reaction. Okay, so how does this happen? Because enzymes have a three-dimensional shape, and so they have a structure, and so we call that a conformation. And there are certain pockets within the surface or on the surface of an enzyme. We call these active sites. And substrates will bind to these active sites based on just the shape. All right, so a reactant has to have a complementary shape to fit into an enzyme. Right. And then, once these substrates bind, because they have the proper shape to the active sites, then the enzyme does something, right? It brings these substrates together so that a reaction can take place. So let's take a look at this, and I'm going to give you a nice little example in just a little bit. So here we have that chemical reaction, right? A plus B going to C plus D. Without an enzyme, that might take 10,000 years to happen. With an enzyme, it might happen in just a couple seconds. And that's really good. Say this reaction was taking place in your body, you couldn't wait around 10,000 years for it to take place, right? So with the help of an enzyme, then it will happen very, very quickly within your lifetime, right? And maybe within seconds. That's the important thing. So let's look at the illustration right here. I've got an enzyme, and I've got two substrates. I got A and B. And look what has to happen. Substrate A has to bind to this active site, and can you see that the substrate has a complementary shape compared to the active site? Right, so if this were a triangular or a square substrate, then there would have to be, what, a square active site in order for that molecule to fit in. Here's substrate B. Kind of has like a little wing right here and a pointed end. A little wing fits in right here, and the pointed end fits in here to the active site just by shape. And when both substrates, A and B, bind to the enzyme, look what happens to them. They fit together really nicely. This thing right here is what we call the enzyme-substrate complex. This thing has to form before the products are formed. Right? And once the enzyme-substrate complex forms, then look at our products. We got products C and D, and you can see that they have changed shape, right? They have changed their structure. All right, so what else do I see on this illustration? Okay, where do I have an enzyme? Here I have a cursor. Tell me where I should go with my cursor to find an enzyme. Go left. Down. Yes, that's an enzyme, right? And is that an enzyme before the reaction, during the reaction, or after? It's before the reaction. Okay, now let's look at the enzyme after the reaction. Where should I go? Right. Right some more. Here's the enzyme after the reaction. Now what's the difference between the enzyme after the reaction compared to before the reaction? They're exactly the same. Same color? Yeah. Same shape? Yep. Same orientation, everything is exactly the same. All right, so the enzyme does not change when it catalyzes this reaction. Now, what about reactants? Do they stay the same? No, they get converted into products. All right, so reactants are used up during this reaction, but the enzyme is not. So it just returns to its original shape, which means that it can catalyze this reaction over again. It doesn't get used up. Right, so it can catalyze this reaction over and over and over and over again, and that's one of the reasons why it speeds up the rate of that reaction. All right, so these substrates have to fit into the active sites. They have to have the right shape. So if we change the shape of this enzyme, maybe by heating it up or putting it in a different pH, right, or doing something to change the shape of this enzyme, guess what will happen to the rate of this chemical reaction if we change the shape of this enzyme? Then the shape of the active sites change. The substrates won't be able to bind to the same degree as before, which means the enzyme-substrate complex won't form, which then means that the products won't form. Enzyme-substrate complex has to form first. All right, so we can't change the shape of this protein. How can we change the shape of a protein? I mentioned something, but there's something that's much more obvious. I said changing the pH, changing the salt concentration. But there's something that you probably even did today by just heating something, by cooking a protein, okay? And when you change the conformation of this protein, that's usually an irreversible step, and then that protein loses its activity and can never go back and catalyze that reaction again, right? So we call that denaturation. If the enzyme is not denatured, then it can catalyze that reaction over and over and over again. All right, so the enzyme does not get used up, but the reactants get used up. But what about the products? Are they changing during the reaction? What about products during this reaction? They change, they start to accumulate, right? Because products are being produced. So substrates go away, products, all right, form as a result of this chemical reaction, but the enzyme stays exactly the same. All right, so why do we call this decreasing the activation energy barrier? Why are these enzymes so important? All right, and it's because it's the way an enzyme can put substrates together to react properly. All right, here I have a couple reactant molecules without an enzyme, and they're just kind of bouncing around in solution, okay, at a certain temperature. If we increase the temperature of this solution, what's going to happen to these substrates, right, or reactants right here? They're just going to move faster, right? And they're going to bump into each other faster, right? Okay. And if there's no enzyme, sometimes the markers will bump together like that, and the reaction won't take place. Because in order to get the product that we want, the blue marker has to bump into the red marker just like that to form a product. And if they bump into each other in any other orientation, what would happen if I were to let go of the red marker? It would just fall down, right? They have to bump into each other just like that in order to form this product. So how many ways can this red marker bump into this blue marker here? Oh, millions of different ways. And the reaction won't take place, right? What the enzyme does is that it makes sure that these two molecules bump into each other in exactly the same way so the reaction takes place. Right, so that's the beauty of an enzyme. And then, of course, the enzyme doesn't get used up. Okay. There's another thing that's really important about enzymes. Don't forget, this is the molecule that we want right here, all right? Blue-red. Sometimes, even without an enzyme, if these two reactant molecules bump into each other, maybe like this, right, they will form a product, but is this the right product compared to this one? No, this is the wrong product. So another thing that an enzyme does is it makes sure that you have a very good yield, almost 100% yield. You get the molecule that your body wants, not some side reaction, not some inappropriate molecule. And sometimes that inappropriate molecule might even hurt the cell or kill the cell. Right? So an enzyme not only speeds up the rate of a reaction, but it makes sure that you get the product, the exact product you need with the right conformation, not some other contaminant that can happen without the enzyme being present. Okay, so what has to form first before products will form? The enzyme substrate complex, right? All right, so that's a good exam figure for you. Maybe just draw it out a couple times. Okay, if that's confusing, you got to see me during office hours because that's really some basic information about that activation energy. All right. How do we name enzymes? Well, in modern nomenclature, we can name an enzyme by the substrate that it works on and then put an ASE at the end of a word. Right? And if there's an ASE at the end of a word, we then automatically know that it's an enzyme. And for instance, if the enzyme works on a lipid, you know what a lipid is, right? If it works on a lipid, maybe degrades a lipid, how would we name that enzyme that degrades a lipid? Yeah, so then we take lipid and put an ASE on the end of it. That's called what? Lipase. Yeah. All right, and so here are a couple other ones. All right, so here is a phosphatase. We know that's an enzyme because of the ASE at the end. And a kinase, got an ASE at the end. We know these are enzymes. They speed up the rate of some kind of reaction. And in particular, these two deal with a phosphate, right, a PO4 functional group. And these are important enzymes we're going to be looking at all semester long. A phosphatase removes a phosphate group from a molecule. Okay, so it lyses a phosphate off. So maybe you want to draw that down over here, right? A phosphatase takes a molecule with a phosphate onto it, and it produces that molecule with a phosphate no longer bound to it chemically. That's what a phosphate does. Maybe I'll just draw that on the board. And a kinase goes the opposite way. All right, so here we have some big molecule, and it has covalently bonded to this inorganic phosphate, right? That's a PO4 group. With a phosphatase, it will go in this direction here, right? There is the molecule plus what? Plus inorganic phosphate. So these are the products. Here's the reactant. And this would be a phosphatase. The opposite direction certainly can happen. Okay? When an inorganic phosphate is joined with that molecule. And that's what we call a kinase. And usually this phosphorus right over here comes from an ATP molecule. Because what does ATP have? It's got three of these, right? Okay. So a phosphatase takes that phosphate off, a kinase puts it on to get into this thing. And so now the shape has changed, right? These two molecules have a different shape. And so what does that mean? It has a different function inside the cell. Okay. All right, so sometimes we name enzymes by the substrate that they work on. Like, for instance, we use a lipase, a protease. Lactate dehydrogenase works on a molecule you're going to be really familiar with, and that's called lactate or lactic acid. Okay, lactate dehydrogenase is an enzyme that works on lactic acid in our bodies. Here are some important enzymes. First one is real important, called catalase. And catalase will take something called hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, and it will break it down into water and oxygen. So let's think about this hydrogen peroxide. You probably have some in a bottle at home, right? And what can you tell me about that bottle? Yeah, it's really dark, so that light doesn't get into it, because light is energy. So if you have hydrogen peroxide, okay, even in a dark bottle, say underneath your sink in a dark cabinet, if we wait maybe 100 years, that hydrogen peroxide will all be converted into water and oxygen, even though it's in that dark bottle. And if we were to take that hydrogen peroxide out from underneath your sink and put an enzyme named catalase, guess what happens to that reaction? Will it take 100 years? No, it will almost happen immediately. And your body produces a catalase-like enzyme, so that when you lacerate yourself and pour hydrogen peroxide on your finger, you see a bunch of bubbles, because that enzyme breaks it down almost immediately. All right? And so we say that enzyme is catalyzing that reaction. All right, so the point I was making here is that hydrogen peroxide will break down into water and oxygen by itself, all by itself, but it will take a long time. With the enzyme, it just speeds up the rate of the reaction. An enzyme can't make this reaction go in the reverse direction, right? It just speeds up the direction that it happens in. Carbonic anhydrase. Ooh, that's another good one. We have carbonic acid going to water and carbon dioxide. Which one of these molecules are you familiar with? Have you ever heard of these molecules before? Any of these molecules before? Yeah, like what? Water. Yeah, that's pretty familiar with that. And, well, what about CO2? Yeah, carbon dioxide. You're probably familiar with that because we know we exhale that from our bodies. Right? So here are two very important molecules in our body. And indeed, our bodies do produce carbonic anhydrase to catalyze this reaction. And when we get to respiratory chapter, and maybe even before, you'll see how important this reaction is. A couple more reactions. Ribonuclease. What's a ribonucleotide? What's a ribonucleotide? Like RNA, yeah? And a ribonuclease is something that will break down RNA into its building blocks. And you know what the building blocks of RNA are, right? They are ribonucleotides. Right? So a ribonuclease undergoes performs what kind of reaction? Here we see water being used up. A hydrolysis reaction, right? That's what, and so ribonuclei represents RNA, and ASE says that it's a enzyme that breaks down RNA. Okay, we talked about lactate dehydrogenase already. All right. Enzyme activity. We have been talking about this. Enzyme activity is just the rate that reactants are converted into products. Sometimes, instead of saying reactants, we say, if it's an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, we say substrates. Substrates are converted into products. And the faster that happens, that means that the enzyme activity has increased. All right, and let's take a look at these graphs here, some more graph reading. Here we have a plot of enzyme activity versus temperature. And when the temperature is really low, like say 0 degrees, what can you tell me about that enzyme activity? it looks like it's almost at zero, right? So that enzyme will not be able to catalyze the reaction, but as we increase the temperature, what happens to the rate of that reaction? It increases. And if we increase the temperature more, the rate of the reaction increases. So is that directly related or inversely related? It's directly related, right? If we increase the temperature, the rate of this reaction increases, right? Up to a point, up to around our body temperature, we're around 37 degrees, right? We see that's pretty much a maximum rate of catalytic activity. And if we increase the temperature after that, higher, okay, to 40, up to 100 degrees, then what happens as we increase the temperature? The activity decreases. So now it's inversely related. And I think you're pretty familiar with this, not in terms of enzyme activity, but in proteins, just generally speaking. All right, so let's just say that we have some hamburger in your refrigerator. Your refrigerator, let's just say, is really close to zero. Not quite freezing, but close to zero. Right? And then we take that hamburger, right, and heat it up to a warm temperature. Is there, and we cook that hamburger, is there going to be a difference in hamburger between when it's in the refrigerator and when it's cooked? Yeah, big difference, right? So there are structural changes. We say that those proteins are denatured. And here is another important point, right? As that protein becomes denatured, we can lower the temperature, and it's an irreversible process. So if we take that cooked hamburger and put it back in the refrigerator, does it go back to looking like raw hamburger? It does not, okay? So it stays denatured. So denaturization, especially when we use temperature or pH or salt concentration or anything like that, denaturation is an irreversible process. There's only one condition that I'm aware of. If you know other conditions, I'd really like to know those. And that is beauticians know how to do that. Because somebody can walk into a beauty shop and say, hey, I have straight hair, and I would really like to have curly hair. And what does a beautician say? No, it can't be done. They say, oh, sure, we can do that, because your hair is made out of protein. We can denature, we can change the conformation of your hair, right? And then form some disulfide bridges. We make some different connections between molecules. Right, and we put the hair in the shape that you want, and then you'll have that curly hair. And that's called what? A permanent. And so those proteins have been denatured. They've changed their shape. But guess what you could do? Maybe the next day you say, oh, I really don't like those curls. You could go back to the beauty shop and say what? Take those curls out. And they can. They can renature that hair so that it's straight again. So when you get a permanent, that is an irreversible change in conformation. But that is the only really wild example, right, that I can think of. And maybe you could recognize that smell, the sulfur smell, because it's dealing with those disulfide bridges in a cysteine amino acid bridge, which is a really strong bridge between different parts of a protein molecule, because it's a covalent bond. Okay, so enzyme activity varies with temperature, and it has an optimal temperature for activity of about 37 to 40 degrees. And if you move away from that temperature, then activity decreases one way or the other. All right, the same thing for pH. What the heck is pH? What does pH mean? It's just a hydrogen ion concentration in solution, or the acidity of that solution. Some enzymes have very good activity at a pH of maybe between 1 and 2, for instance, pepsin. And pepsin is released into the stomach, and so what does the pH of the stomach have to be so that pepsin has activity to perform whatever it's performing? The stomach has to be very acidic, between pH 1 and 2. And pepsin is important to break those peptide bonds down. Peptide bonds are really stable, hard to break apart. Not only are they covalent, but they're very stable bonds. All right, so pepsin in the stomach does that initial digestion, and that can only happen at a really radical pH, very acidic pH. All right, and then that material for final digestion moves from the stomach to another part of your body, and look what happens to the pH. It changes. It becomes now very, very basic, and the enzyme trypsin then can break these proteins down into amino acids. can break down a protein completely. Right? But trypsin will only work at a very high pH, like 9, and that's the pH that we see in the small intestine. Most of your body, what's the pH of most of your body? We saw just two really radical different areas here, stomach and small intestine, and they're different. One is highly acidic, one is highly basic, but most of your body is what? Yeah, it's about 7.3, something like that, and that's where most of the enzymes in our body have their optimal activity. And a good example of that would be salivary amylase, which is an enzyme that is produced by salivary glands, and it breaks down sugar molecules into building blocks, right? And that will happen at a pH of 7. Now, if we take salivary amylase and put it in your stomach where there is a pH of 1, what happens to the activity of amylase? Yeah, look at this. It goes down, goes down, goes down, goes to 0, and by that time, probably denatured, and you'll never be able to get that activity back. Okay. Or if we take salivary amylase and put it in the small intestine, what happens to activity? It goes down. We're changing the shape of that enzyme so much that the active site is destroyed, enzyme-substrate complex can't form, and therefore the product can't form either. All right, so enzyme activity depends on temperature, pH, but also salt concentration. All right, so you know you can cook food using temperature, which is just denaturing a protein. What are some other ways that you can cook food besides heating them up? Everybody's aware of it. How about changing the pH? Taking some fish, for instance. I'm thinking that I'm starting to salivate already. Take some fish and put it in an acid like lemon juice, okay, and you make some ceviche, and so that cooks the proteins, that denatures the fish proteins at what? Low temperature, all right, just by changing the pH. And you can do the same thing with salt. There are many foods that are preserved and cooked with salt, all right, that change the conformation of those proteins and preserves them. Yeah. Yeah, hi. When you change the temperature or pH, you're changing the shape of that protein because it likes to wiggle around, right? It's just wiggling around all the time. You increase the temperature, it starts to bounce around even more and more and more, and every once in a while, it bounces so far that it can't go back to that initial conformation. So now that shape has changed and won't ever go back. We call that denaturation. And when the enzyme changes shape, then the active site, the shape of that active site changes to where it might not even bind the substrate molecules anymore. Same thing for pH, yeah, or salt. Yeah.
So when the temperature is really cold, it's also denatured, meaning it's the structure
that has changed. Oh, that's a really good question. Okay, so from this point to the right is denaturation. Okay, and there's a decrease in enzyme activity. And you're right, I see a decrease in enzyme activity over here as well. But it's not because of denaturation. It's just because as the temperature gets colder and colder, the substrate molecules at warm temperature are bouncing around fast, they're moving around fast. As the temperature decreases, what happens? They start to slow down, which means it takes a longer time to get to the enzyme, to bind. So on the left-hand side, they're not denatured. It's just that the movement of these molecules have slowed down so much that it decreases the rate of that chemical reaction. Okay? Yeah. So that if you heat that enzyme up, molecules start to move more, the active site is still preserved, and you're still good. The enzyme will have the same activity. Okay. So on the left-hand side, yes, you can slide up and you can slide down. And if you slide down, you can slide up just by changing the temperature. And I guess, you know, you could have some hamburger in the refrigerator at this temperature, take it out, and say that you're going to put it on the barbecue. And before you get it on the barbecue, let's just say it's at 30 degrees, you get a phone call, and your friend says, oh, you got to go shoot some pool with me. What am I going to say? No, I got to cook a hamburger? Well, no, for sure I'm going to put that hamburger back in the refrigerator, and when I do, does that hamburger in the refrigerator look the same as before I took it out? Yeah, it will look the same. right? If, as long as I don't cook it, it will look the same, right? And then if I warm it up again, it will look the same. If I cool it back down, it will look the same. It's only when I get to this point right here and denature it does it become an irreversible change. Okay. All right, so here are just some enzymes, and you know these are all enzymes because I've seen ASE on most of these. Right, so if it's an enzyme that people have discovered in recent time, then we use that nomenclature, and it just shows what the optimal pH is and what some of the activity is, like a phosphatase. What the heck is a phosphatase once again? Yeah, you're going to have to write that one out over the weekend. Make sure you know that one. Okay. It what? It removes a phosphate group from a molecule, and that's a big little group right here. When you take that phosphate off, it really changes the shape of this protein a lot. And when you change the shape of something, you change its activity. That's a phosphatase. And it's not on this list right here, but what's the opposite of a phosphatase? A kinase. That's right. All right, so that seems kind of counterintuitive to me. Why would you have an enzyme that takes a phosphate off and an enzyme that puts one on? That seems that they're working against each other. Why does your body do that? Do you think that's a good thing? What does that mean? What do you see right there? I see antagonism, right? And what does it mean when you have antagonistic mechanisms, like a phosphatase working with a kinase? Antagonistic mechanisms. That means you have precise control and balance of these different substrate and product molecules. And a really good example of that from musculoskeletal anatomy, right, if you want to have precise control and balance of your fingertip, like maybe tomorrow you're going to get pulled over by that person with the badge and the sidearm and the fancy blue cap, right, and they're going to say, put your fingertip on the tip of your nose with your eyes closed, and you go like that. Okay, you have precise control and balance of that fingertip because what's working? Is your biceps just working? No, because if it was just working, right, you'd be smacking yourself in the eye or maybe the officer in the eye or something like that. Because when you got to your nose, you couldn't stop. Besides the biceps, what do you need? The triceps, right? Their action is exactly opposite. They work together so you have precise control and balance of that fingertip. Another good example would be your automobile. You have precise control of your automobile because why? What do you have two things working against each other? Yeah, the gas pedal and the brake pedal, right? If you only had a gas pedal, yeah, you might be able to get home if you're careful. But once you got home, you would just have to wave goodbye because you couldn't stop, right? So antagonistic mechanisms are super important. And here is just, in terms of enzymes, another important example. Okay. Here's a definition, cofactor and coenzymes. I want you to understand these two different terms right here. They're going to have different purposes in our body. And these two things are necessary for normal activity of enzymes. So a coenzyme works with an enzyme, but it's not really quite an enzyme. A cofactor works with an enzyme, but it's not really an enzyme. So what are these things? Cofactors are really small metal ions, like sodium, magnesium, okay, calcium, even manganese. Oh, was manganese on the test? Maybe it was. All right. You don't need a whole lot of these chemicals in your body for enzymatic activity, but you need to have some. So a cofactor, right, are these things. A coenzyme are things that are derived from vitamins. These are huge organic molecules. These are really big organic molecules. So what does that mean? Well, there's carbon bonded to hydrogen, and you can throw in nitrogen and phosphorus and other kinds of things, right? But it's a huge molecule. Cofactors are really small, right? They're just these ions. And a coenzyme will transport a molecule from one metabolic pathway to another. So it's kind of like a delivery system. A coenzyme delivers something from one reaction to another so that it doesn't get lost. And a cofactor doesn't deliver anything. It just increases the activity of an enzyme. Okay. All right. So don't forget, is a coenzyme large or small? It's small. And a cofactor is really tiny, right? It's really, really small. And it's not organic. It's just an elemental metal ion in solution. All right, so that will work really well for this class. Maybe not for all classes, but it's going to work really well. All right, so here is another slide. And here we see an enzyme. And I see an enzyme, I see one pathway on the top, one pathway on the bottom. All right, so I see two different pathways and actually two different enzymes. Let's look at the top one first. All right, so here I see a couple substrates. And these substrates sort of fit into the active site, but not quite right. So without this cofactor bound to the enzyme, the active site just doesn't have the proper shape to bind substrates. And if the enzyme can't bind substrates, what can't form? The enzyme-substrate complex. And if the enzyme-substrate complex doesn't form, then products aren't formed. All right, so these active sites have to reach the proper configuration to match up with these substrates. So what happens in biology is that sometimes a cofactor can bind to a site on the enzymes other than the active site, and when it does, it changes the active site so the substrates now match up to it more perfectly. So with this cofactor bound to the enzyme, then the enzyme-substrate complex forms, which means what? The products form as a result of that. Without the cofactor, the rate of that reaction is not increased because that's what the job of an enzyme is, right? All right, so a cofactor can bind to a site other than the active site. The second line over here, where is that cofactor binding? Within the active site, right? It's in the same location. And since it's in that same location as the active site, now the active site has the proper shape so that substrates can bind to it, substrate complex can form, and products can form. Yeah, in most cases, it's just an equilibrium. So if you have a lot of that cofactor, like billions of molecules over here, then that binding site on the enzyme will be occupied by a cofactor all the time. But if there's very few cofactor molecules, then some of these, when they jump off of that binding site, right, they're going to stay in solution. They won't jump back on the enzyme. Yeah. Oh, you know what? When this thing comes off, these things get kicked out. Oh. Yeah. Okay. I don't know of any scientific studies that show that, but since when we add this cofactor or take it off, the conformation of this enzyme changes. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I tell you what, maybe something like this. I just saw it, but take a look at the shape of the enzyme over here compared to the shape of the enzyme right here. Does it look like it has the same shape? You're going to have to look really carefully. This end over here kind of looks like it has the same shape, but what about this one here? Right? Once it's bound to the cofactor, it has like this little hook. See that little hook? Which is not the same over here. So when the cofactor binds, the shape of the enzyme or the shape of the active site does definitely change. Okay. And if we were to take that cofactor off, then probably this thing would go back to this condition over here. It would not be as perfect an active site to bind these substrates. So that maybe sort of answers your question. Okay. And the same thing for this enzyme down here. Got a little bit of a hook, but it's much more pronounced down over here. Now this is what I would like for you to draw in on this slide. When the cofactor binds to a site on the enzyme that's not the active site, we call that allosteric regulation. Allosteric. Yeah. Actually, I want to end this show and where did it go? And I want to show you this slide. It's not in your notes. I just modified it on the way to class. Okay, it's this one right here. All right, so let's look at the slide on the left. When a cofactor binds to an enzyme, right, and in this case, is it binding to the active site or some other site on the enzyme? Some other site on the enzyme, we call that allosteric. All right, it's still changing the conformation of the enzyme, but it's allosteric. Huh? because it's binding to a site that's not the active site. All right, it's just binding to a cofactor site on the enzyme. But what it does, it changes the shape of that enzyme. When you change the shape of something, you change its function. And we're talking about enzyme activity in terms of function. Now, if that same cofactor or a different cofactor doesn't bind to a site other than the active site, but within the active site, which is the second circumstance, see it here, within the active site, we don't call that allosteric, right? We call that orthosteric, right? But most of the time, we're going to be interested in allosteric regulation. That's one way that enzyme activity can be regulated in your body. It can be enhanced or decreased, allosteric regulation. Okay, so do you see how to spell allosteric and orthosteric? Yeah, okay. So two different types of regulation. All right, so I want to end this show. Maybe if I can remember to put that in Blackboard, I will. Or maybe you could remind me. Chapter 4. Oh, yeah, good. Here it is. All right, so let's get started with this one. We'll boot this one back up. And we'll display it like so. And then I'm going to get my cursor back. Okay. All right, so allosteric regulation versus orthostatic regulation. Enzyme activation, control of enzyme activity, which means then your body has control of certain chemical reactions. Many enzymes are produced in an inactive form. And this is good because they're digestive enzymes. The pancreas produces lots of digestive enzymes. And if they were produced in an active form, guess what would happen to the pancreas? It would get digested, right? So those precursors, those proenzymes, then are released into a tube. They move into the small intestine where they're activated, and there they can digest food without digesting the pancreas, right? So that protects against self-digestion. Many are activated by phosphorylation, like we saw right here. What kind of enzyme do you need for phosphorylation? It's a kinase, right? And some are activated by dephosphorylation, or some are inactivated by dephosphorylation. Okay. Others are activated by ligands, small molecules called second messengers. We're going to look at some examples of that, enzyme activation. Enzymes have some characteristics that are very similar to receptors. Right? Maybe you remember this curve from when we were looking at receptors. And okay, if we have an enzyme in solution and we start to add substrate to it, that's this axis on the horizontal axis, right? So right at here, there's no substrate. What can you tell me about the reaction, right, from left to right if there are no substrates? Then there's no chemical reaction. We put some substrates in solution, guess what happens to the rate of the reaction? It increases. And if we put more substrates in, what happens? It increases some more, but then it starts to level off a little bit, right? So this first part of the curve, it's direct. The reaction rate is directly related to substrate concentration. And sooner or later, you're going to have so much substrate in solution that all of the active sites are bound to substrate. So if we add more substrates, the enzyme can't work any faster. It can't, can't convert reactants into products any faster because all the enzyme is already busy doing as much as it can. We call that saturation. Same thing for receptors. They can be saturated. And this is highly specific, meaning that the shape of the substrate has to match the shape of that active site. Here's an important concept in chemistry, reversible reactions. All right. At the very beginning of the class, we looked at a pretty fancy diagram of that ball with the activation energy barrier, right? And we had reactants and we had products. Was the energy level of the reactant and the product the same, or were they different? Okay. We had reactants up over here. It rolled down the hill, and as it rolled down the hill, what happened to the energy? They lost energy. Okay, so the energy level is different in that example between reactants and products. There are some reactions where the energy level doesn't change, right? The reactants and the products stay at the same energy level. We call these reversible reactions. Yeah. Yeah, right here. Okay, here we have reaction rate. which means how fast the enzyme is working, right? And if there's no substrates in that solution, we have plenty of good enzyme ready to go to work. But if there are no substrates, there's something that cannot form. What can't form? The enzyme substrate complex can't form because there's no substrates. And the enzyme substrate complex has to form before a product is formed. All right, so there is no enzymatic, there's no activity without substrates. Because the enzyme has to work on something, has to form that enzyme substrate complex. As we increase, if we add some substrates now, they can bind to the active site and the enzyme can convert them into products. And if we add more substrate, then that reaction rate increases. Right? So we see that there's a nice direct relationship. As we increase the substrate concentration or how much A and B we have in solution, then the reaction rate increases. Right? But it begins to slow down. And then finally, the rate doesn't go any faster because now, right, all the enzyme that we have is already bound to A and B. And all the active sites are bound. So if we put more A and B in solution, they can't bind to the enzyme because there's an A and B on it already. Okay? And those A's and B's are just going to stay A's and B's. They can't be converted into C's and D's because they don't form an enzyme substrate complex. There's no enzyme for them to bind to. Okay? And so that's what we call saturated. Okay, reversible reaction. So here's a reaction, water, carbon dioxide, and then carbonic acid. Right? So the reactants are on the left, the product is on the right, and here's an arrow showing how that happens. Now what can you tell me about this arrow right here? Is it one way or two way? It's a two way arrow. Right? That's just one way of saying that the energy of water and carbon dioxide is equal to the energy of carbonic acid. Right, so they're at the same level. One is not higher than the other. Which then also means that nothing has to roll uphill for that reaction to happen. With that first one, right, when the bowl rolled downhill, it can't automatically roll uphill. But if they're at the same level, right, they can roll back and forth. But there's something that determines which way they do roll. Okay? And we call that the law of mass action. Sometimes we call it Le Chatelier's principle. And it just says that when the energy of reactants and products are the same, right, they can interconvert, and the way they move is going to be determined by the concentration. So for instance, if we add carbon dioxide to this mixture right here, it's going to force the reaction to the right. Right? So if we add carbon dioxide, it's going to force this reaction so that carbon dioxide goes down back to where, or more closely back to where it was at the beginning. Add carbon dioxide, it forces the reaction to the right. Let's consider water. If we add water to this reaction, what do you think is going to happen? It's going to force the reaction to the right, just as if we added carbon dioxide. Right? So if we add anything over here on the left, it's going to increase the number of molecules on the right. Because these things can go back and forth, there's no energy change. All right. So the reverse is true. If we take carbon dioxide out, right, then some of this carbonic acid will move to the left to replenish that carbon dioxide that was taken out. So these things can interchange. So what? Let's look at this circumstance. Let's put more carbonic acid in the solution. What's going to happen? If we increase concentration of carbonic acid, what's going to happen to this reaction? Is it going to stay the same, or is it going to go to the left or go to the right? Will water and carbon dioxide go to the right, or carbonic acid go to the left? Yeah, if we increase concentration of carbonic acid, it's going to force the reaction to the left. If we remove carbonic acid, it's going to force the reaction to the right. Yeah. Okay. You can always see me after class. So we call that the law of mass action. So these things will move around based on concentration. All right, so if your body produces a lot of carbon dioxide, guess what else it's going to make? As we increase carbon dioxide, your body's going to make carbonic acid, right? And that's just the law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. All right, now that reaction doesn't happen very fast by itself, but what can we do to get this reaction to speed up so that it works properly in our lifetime? We can put an enzyme in there, right? And that enzyme increases the rate of this interconversion, so it has an active site that can bind water and carbon dioxide and carbonic acid. The name of that enzyme is called carbonic anhydrase, because here is carbonic acid, carbonic anhydrase. So that's a good thing that you'll be tested on sometime. I don't know if it's on the first test or test after that, but what's the name of the enzyme that interconverts carbonic acid and carbon dioxide in water? And then you would say carbonic anhydrase. Okay. And what does carbonic anhydrase do? Speeds up that interconversion process. Okay. So that's something about enzymes. Let's use some enzymes and develop a metabolic pathway. All right. So here is a good illustration. I see molecule A right here, and then here is molecule B, and C, and D, and E, and then finally F. So these are different molecules. They have different shapes. And to convert B to C, to make that reaction happen fast, what does your body do? It produces an enzyme to catalyze that reaction, right? And it produces a number of enzymes because all these substrates have a different shape. So here is that initial substrate. It's converted into B with a certain enzyme. We'll just call that enzyme number one. And so A is going to go away, and what's going to happen to B? It's going to form, right? So B will appear as A disappears, right? Because A is going to be converted into B. And then here is another enzyme that can take B, and when B builds up, what can enzyme number two do? It can take B and make C out of it, right? And when C builds up, okay, it bumps into another enzyme, enzyme number three, and what does enzyme number three do? Converts C into D, and finally another enzyme can convert D into E, and then enzyme number five, the very last enzyme, can convert E into F, the very last product. That's the final product. So when we have a molecule that has to go through many steps to get to the final product, we call that a metabolic pathway. Okay, so the substrate is what we start with, the product is what we end up with, and all these steps in the middle are what we call intermediates. Right? So B is an intermediate, C is an intermediate, D and E are intermediates. They're not the final product. All right, so here I got a tricky question for you. Here's enzyme number four. Can enzyme number four take B and convert it into E? It likes to convert to E, right? But can it take B and convert it into E? You're going to say no. And the reason is because B doesn't have the right shape to fit onto the active site of enzyme 4. So the enzyme substrate complex can't form, which means E cannot form, right? So enzyme 4 only converts D to E. Okay, so that's what we call a metabolic pathway. Some metabolic pathways have branches to them. So you have product A, and product A can be converted into F, or maybe something similar or different called F prime, right? So there's a difference between F and F prime. These are the final products, right? So which way is this going to go, right? When you get to C, it can be converted into D or it can be converted into D prime, and your body would like to determine how that functions. Okay, so this is how it happens, especially with this, we call this a branch point. C is a branch point. So let's just say this bottom pathway is operating, right? The bottom metabolic pathway is operating. So what will happen to A? A will disappear, and what will form? Okay, but I want you to think in terms of the metabolic pathway. A will disappear, and then F prime will form, okay, due to this bottom pathway. And your body needs F prime, but it has to be the right level to maintain homeostasis, just like glucose in your blood. Can't be too high, can't be too low. And as F prime increases in concentration, right, it can bind to enzyme number 3 in such a way that it changes the activity of that enzyme so that it decreases. Right, so what was the initial stimulus? An increase in F, but when we inhibit this pathway, enzyme number 3, what happens to F prime? It stops being produced, right? Because it's at the proper level. So here we see some feedback, and what kind of feedback would we call this? If F prime is going to stay the same level, all right, then that's going to be a nice negative feedback mechanism, not positive, because positive feedback would be what? Well, then we got to make more F prime. And if it's positive, then more F prime. And then if it's positive, and then the whole world would be filled up with F, actually the whole universe would be filled up with F prime, right? If it was a positive feedback mechanism. All right, well, what F prime is at, the proper level to maintain homeostasis, there is enough to inhibit this enzyme, and C doesn't get stuck, because what can happen to C now? It can participate in this top metabolic pathway, right? And C then gets converted into F instead of F prime. And so this kind of control, we call this allosteric inhibition, right? Because here is something binding to a site other than the active site, and these that allosteric inhibition works at this point right here in the metabolic pathway. What do we call this point right here? That's a branch point. Yeah, so a branch point. Okay, it requires two different enzymes, but this branch point right here is something that you can use to convert the process from making F or F prime, depending on the condition of these two final products. So we call that end product inhibition. All right, so that's it for enzymes. Bioenergetics. Okay, this is a pretty cool topic. And I got to cover these two today. Maybe not everything today, but at least these two things. So we got a couple laws of thermodynamics. And it tells us something about energy. But you know what? I've been using that term energy, and I'm not sure anybody knows what that is. What does energy... What does energy do for you? What does energy mean? Okay, I mean, if I have a dollar, I know what that means. But if I have energy, what does that mean? Oh, some of you have maybe taken a physics class or something. But energy, yeah, just means that you have the ability to do work. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, if I'm on the top stair over there, do I need energy to get down the stairs down here? But if I'm at the top stair... Do I need energy? Yeah, no, I can just relax everything, fall down, and then I'll roll down the stairs. I don't need energy, okay? But what do I need to go from this low level back to the top row back there? Do I need energy to go up there? Yes, okay? So energy gives me the ability to do work, like climb stairs, for instance. You don't need energy to come down the stairs in that really sloppy fashion, okay? So that's what energy is. It's just the ability to do work. When you have a lot of energy, means you can do what? A lot of work. When you have no energy, you can't do very much work, right? Okay, so here's the first law of thermodynamics. It states that energy can never be created or destroyed, right? The amount of energy in the universe is the same. It's constant. But energy can be converted from one form to another. It can be transformed. Sometimes we call that transformed. And let's think of some examples. Can anybody think of some kind of process that converts energy from one form to another form? I can think of my car, okay, for instance, and I got just a typical kind of car. It's not like an electric vehicle or anything. So in order to get my car to do work, what kind of energy do I have to put into it? Gasoline? And gasoline is chemical energy, right? There's energy in those covalent bonds. And in order for my car to do work, right, it takes that energy in that chemical form and does what with it? Converts it into mechanical energy so that I can drive down the road. All right, the energy of that gasoline is still in our world right here. It has just changed forms, okay? All right, what's another way of converting energy? Oh, light bulb right here. What's it converting? It's converting electrical energy into light energy. And light is energy, right? That's a transducer. What do you know that can go the other way? Can transform light energy into electrical energy? Well, eyes can do that, right? Because that's a receptor for light. It changes electrical properties of our eyes. And here's my favorite organism. Okay, here is an organism that can take light energy and convert it into chemical energy. What can do that? Can you do that? Can you take light energy and convert it into chemical energy? You can't, right? I'm really jealous. Who can? Plants can, right? Plants can take light energy and convert it into chemical energy by making glucose, right? They can take carbon dioxide, jam them all together to make that big hydrocarbon, right? So that's the first law of thermodynamics, right? Energy can change forms, but can't be created or destroyed. All right, here is the second law. It states that energy transformations always increase the degree of disorganization of a system. If something is going to happen, right, disorganization has to increase. Something won't become organized all by itself. Right? So energy will flow only when systems become more disorganized. And that's why I have this example right here. Okay. I have a bunch of dominoes. And can you see this is just a random stack of dominoes right here? And can you see that there's more order in this stack of dominoes on the right? I made this nice skyscraper right here. So would you agree that here's more organization than here? Okay, more organization in the skyscraper than this pile right here. All right, so what's going to happen just spontaneously by itself? Will these disorganized dominoes ever all of a sudden appear as these organized dominoes? No. What about these organized dominoes going back to or going to this disorganized state? Will that happen automatically? Yeah, absolutely. That's all that that statement says. When you have organization, it has a tendency to become disorganized. Okay. So this is high entropy because it's disorganized. This is low. So entropy is always increased. Okay, so is that a great demonstration? Pretty good, pretty good. But I'm sure you're waiting for the piece de resistance, which is what? Should we try?
Yeah.
Oh, it's not forming. Terrible thing. What about here? Woo, easy to do, right? Organized to disorganized, right? That's a law of thermodynamics right there. Okay, here's something else. Only free energy, energy that was in that organized state, can be used to do work. So you need organization to do work, like break that building down, right? It has to be in an organized state. All right, so systems tend to go from states of high free energy or a lot of organization to states of lower energy, lower free energy, which is more random. Okay, so those are the laws of bioenergetics. Okay, so here we have a diagram of free energy. And we've got a plant right here. We've got some molecules like carbon dioxide and water. And, oh, what's C6H12O6? Oh, it's glucose. Okay, so that's a sugar. You're familiar with that. Okay. And so there is very little organization in these six CO2 molecules and six water molecules. And there's a lot of organization in this glucose. All right? So the glucose has a lot more energy in it, and it's shown on this diagram, than all of these carbon dioxides and water. So which way would this process just want to go spontaneously by itself? From CO2 to glucose or glucose to CO2? It will want to go from glucose to CO2, right? Because it's going to be more disorganized with these same atoms when they're in carbon dioxide and water as opposed to this really organized molecule glucose. All right, but what can plants do? Plants can actually produce this glucose from carbon dioxide and water, but what do they need to do? They have to have energy, right? That can happen because how did I build that building to begin with? I used energy, right, in my body to build that building. So we can produce a highly organized state, but, okay, what else has to happen? Energy is required to do that, right? So how does a plant make something very organized, like glucose, from something that's not organized, like carbon dioxide and water? It needs an energy source to do that. And where does it get that energy? From the sun. Okay. All right, so plants obtain sunlight, use it to make a high free energy glucose molecule from carbon dioxide and water that have less free energy. That doesn't happen spontaneously, right? But plants have figured out a way how to do that. And then, what do we use in our body for energy? These highly organized molecules that we get from plants. All right, so then we can break these glucose molecules down, and when they get broken down like that, what is released? That energy is released, and when it's released, what can we do? We can do work as a result of that. All right, so plants certainly are one of my favorite kinds of organisms. right. And so what is what's an important building block of basic of all life on this planet? Ah, look at oxygen over here. Okay, but that doesn't allow photosynthesis to take place. What allows photosynthesis to take place? What's necessary for photosynthesis? It's not glucose and oxygen. That's the result of photosynthesis. But if we want photosynthesis to take place, what molecules do we need? We need carbon dioxide and water. If we take carbon dioxide away, what happens to photosynthesis? It stops, right? So the basic life-giving molecule, okay, on this planet is carbon dioxide because that's what's necessary for photosynthesis to take place. Okay, maybe you've talked about some of these in lab, reactions that release energy versus reactions that absorb energy. All right, so let's take a look at this plot of free energy versus a reaction of glucose being broken down into CO2 and water. And there's more organization in glucose than there is in CO2 and water, so it has a higher free energy. And it can be broken down into various steps, smaller and smaller molecules, and when it gets broken down, it releases energy. So any kind of reaction that releases energy, which means that the products have lower energy than the reactants, we call that an exergonic reaction. All right, so going from step A, step one, to step two, that's an exergonic reaction because it releases energy. And then from two to three, that releases energy. That's an exergonic reaction. All right, what about going the other way? Carbon dioxide and water being put together to make glucose. That's what we call an endergonic reaction. This is what plants do. All right, so how does a plant take carbon dioxide and water to make glucose? What does it need? It needs energy, right? And that energy comes from light. So on that previous slide, this previous slide right here, okay, what kind of reaction is this? CO2 and water going to glucose. Low energy to high energy. That means energy has to go in. This is an endergonic reaction. When it's the other way, when it goes glucose to CO2 and water, like we have right here, this is releasing energy. We call that an exergonic reaction. All right, so just remember that exergonic reactions, the products have less energy than the reactants, and that energy is released. An endergonic reaction is the opposite. Endergonic means that the products have more free energy than the reactants do. Okay. All right. What time do we end here? But who knows if that clock is right. And I don't have a clock here. Is it about time?
12:45.
Okay. 12:45. We must be close to 12:45. All right. So next time, I'm going to start right here. So think of some of those concepts that we talked about today, because we got to finish up just a couple more things with regard to energy. And what's your favorite energy molecule? ATP. Yeah. Okay. I maybe would say glucose, but